The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Well, good afternoon. Can you hear me? Am I good? I think it's on. It's on? All right. Welcome to Inhumane Gentleness, Integrating the Humanities Through Shakespeare. My name is Sean Hadley. I'm going to be starting our presentation off this morning. I'm here with my friend Sean, who is more the Shakespeare half of this presentation. You should ask him later about Hamlet. It's great. But we both worked together at Trinitas Christian School in Pensacola, I want to start off by saying I'm not known for being funny, but I've noticed a lot of presenters start off with a funny little anecdote that they circle back around to. I'm not going to circle back around to this, but I'll tell you a joke because Kurt Vonnegut said it was the funniest joke he ever heard. And so it's crowd dependent. So I need you, when I ask my question, I need you to say no. Even if you know the answer, you have to say no, right? So. Do you know why they quit selling milk in glass bottles?
No.
The cows got tired of sitting on those bottles. See, it's not very funny. But it was the funniest joke that Vonnegut knew. And so he liked to tell it before speeches. And like I said, I won't be circling back around to it, but it makes me laugh. First of all, thank you for being here. I don't know why you're here instead of at Louis Marcos, but really, thank you for being here. In the course of my time in teaching at a classical Christian school, one of the great things that I've found, the hurdles to overcome, is really this slave driver of time, in a sense. We have so much curriculum. We're inviting students into this tradition, this wonderful conversation, and we don't feel like we can ever give them enough of it. What we've done at Trinitas, I think, is perhaps a way of dealing faithfully with this issue of time in a way that does justice to the work, but is also rewarding for the student and the teacher. And so we're going to kind of run through the philosophy and some practical applications of that. I'd actually like to start out, if you'll flip over to the scene from Shakespeare that you'll find stapled to the back of your handout. I'd like to read this out loud. If you guys wouldn't mind participating along with me, I need a Paris. Is anybody willing to be Paris? I'll volunteer you. Paris, yeah. I do not care, no. I taught a seventh grade group that only had three girls. And so we, you know, got to do what you got to do. Okay, so we got a Paris. I need a Deiphobus. Anybody out there want to be Deiphobus? All right. Steve, come on, you got me. All right. I need an Aeneas. Everybody wants to be Aeneas, come on. Right, he's the best. All right. Okay, yeah, Sean, yeah, you'd be Aeneas, right. And then we do need a Diomedes, and I'll actually round us out with the Diomedes there at the end. So this is Act 4, Scene 1. I give you just a little context. It's in the midst of the Trojan War. Paris is kind of having a conversation throughout most of this act with Diomedes. There's getting ready to be a prisoner swap. I don't know if any of you remember Antenor from the Iliad, but they're getting ready to swap this character Cressida for Antenor. And so this is taking place unbeknownst to Diomedes. Cressida is in love with a fellow by the name of Troilus, who is one of the sons of Priam. And so this is going to prove to be a bit more difficult than anticipated. But so we begin here in the scene with a couple of the Trojans kind of hanging out. Paris, yeah, read.
Oh,
sorry.
And he's wearing the right shirt.
He does. He is. Yeah. Come on. You got Paris? You got Paris. All right.
See ho. Who is that there?
It is the Lord, Aeneas.
Is the prince there in person? Had I so good occasion to lie long as you, Prince Paris, nothing but heavenly business should rob my bedmate of my company.
That's my mind, too. Good morrow, Lord Aeneas.
A valiant Greek, Aeneas, take his hand. Witness the process of your speech, wherein you told how Diomed a whole week by day did haunt you in the field. Health to you, valiant sir, during all question of the gentle truce. But when I meet you armed, as black defiance as heart can think or courage execute.
The one and the other Diomed embraces. Our bloods are now in calm and so long health. But when contention and occasion meet, by Jove, I'll play the hunter for thy life with all my force, pursuit, and policy.
And thou shalt hunt a lion that will fly with his face backwards. Inhumane gentleness, welcome to Troy. Now by Anchises' life, welcome indeed. By Venus's hand, I swear, no man alive can love in such a sort the thing he means to kill more excellent.
We sympathize. Jove, let Aeneas live. If to my sword his fate be not the glory, 1,000 complete courses of the sun. But in mine emulous honor, let him die, with every joint a wound, and that tomorrow.
We know each other well.
We do, and long to know each other worse.
This is the most despiteful, gentle greeting, the noblest, hateful love that e'er I heard of. What business, Lord, so early? I was sent for to the king, but why, I know not. His purpose meets you. 'Twas to bring this brief to Calchas' house, and there to render him, for the infreed Antenor, the fair Crescent. Let's have your company, or, if you please, haste there before us. I constantly believe, or rather call my thought a certain knowledge, my brother Troilus lodges there tonight. Rouse him, give him a note of our approach, with the whole quality whereof I fear we shall be much unwelcome.
That I assure you. Troilus and rather Troy were born to Greece than Crescent born from Troy.
There is no help. The bitter disposition of the time will have it so. Onward, we follow you.
Good morrow, all.
And tell me, noble Diomed, faith, tell me true. Even in the soul of sound good fellowship, who in your thoughts deserves fair Helen the best? Myself or Menelaus?
Both alike. He merits well to have her that doth seek her, not making any scruple of her soyer, with such a hell of pain and world of charge, and you as well to keep her that defend her, not palatating the taste of her dishonor, with such a costly loss of wealth and friends. He, like a pulling cuckold, would drink up the lees and dregs of a flat, tamed peace. You, like a lecher, out of whorish loins, are pleased to breed out your inheritors. Both merits poised, each weighs nor less nor more, but he is he, the heavier for a whore.
You are too bitter to your countrywoman.
She's bitter to her country. Hear me, Paris. For every false drop in her body veins, a Grecian's life hath sunk. For every scruple of her contaminated carrion weight, a Trojan hath been slain. Since she could speak, she hath not given so many good words breath as for her Greeks and Trojans suffered death.
Fair Diomed, you do as chapmen do, dispraise the thing that they desire to buy. But we in silence hold this virtue well, will not commend that not intend to sell. Here lies our way.
All right, thank you guys. Just real quick before we get into it, what are some things you observe about this very short scene that might lead into a variety of disciplines? Anything that pops out at you? I mean, I have my own list. Do you notice any historical elements? No? No historical elements? How about the closing line? What's a chapman? Is that native to Troy? Is that a historical anachronism, do you think? I don't know. It's a good question. How about the literature? Do you see any literature points that could be drawn out? Things done with the language.
Shakespeare's still the king of insults.
Most certainly, yeah. And yet pretty faithful to Homer. It'd be easy to put this in conversation with the Iliad, or even portions of the Aeneid if you're really ambitious. How about theology? Are there any aspects of theology that you could draw out of this very short text? I mean, there's a super easy one. It's a softball. Comes straight out of the Ten Commandments. Yeah, right? So there's an issue of marital fidelity, right, going on in the story. In fact, it seems to be the driving force behind everything that's being said, not just of Helen, but even of Cressida, of Troilus, of Diomedes, of all of them. Of Agamemnon, who's not even in this scene, all right, of Menelaus, sorry, not Agamemnon, Menelaus, who's not even in this scene. So in this very short scene, which I think is a beautiful scene and engages the imagination, Shakespeare manages to touch on all three of these primary disciplines that we tend to teach in classical Christian schools. And I think that's a great way of kind of leading into why Shakespeare is so good at this, or why, better put, why he is the best vehicle for this. And I want to go back to what I said earlier about the challenge of time. In your handout, there's a quote from The King of Elfland's Daughter that I want to read to you really quick. He turned to Lizrael and told her how 10 or 12 years were gone, but it was as though a humble man who had wed an earthly princess should tell her he had lost sixpence. Time had no value or meaning to Lizrael, and she was untroubled to hear of the 10 lost years. She did not dream what time means to us here. If you haven't read Lord Dunsany's King of Elfland's Daughter, it's beautiful. I really encourage it to you. But essentially, this prince has gone and married the fairy princess, and in the span of a few days in Elfland has come back and realized that 10 years have passed in our land. That should sound familiar, because Lewis takes this same concept and embeds it in the Narnia Chronicles. And so it brings out this very important aspect, I think, and that reading is always an invitation into the home of the other. Right? Time does not function in a text the way it functions here. Time is always something different. And that can actually feed into the problem in the classroom of trying to get through the material. I've got 25 chapters in this book, and I got to get through all of them, right? And the more sprawling the timeline of a book is, the more pressure there can be to cover it all, right? You've got this massive tome from Herodotus that it's called the Persian War, but it covers everything, and there's this pressure to get through it all, right? But one of the things that we need to kind of imbibe from Lizrael is that time is not really lost when we're engaged in reading. It may, in fact, feel that way. But there isn't really a way that you can lose time with reading, because there's always a gain, right? So the knight, the young prince who is married Lizrael, in this moment he feels great remorse because his beloved doesn't understand that he's going to age and die, right? But at the same time he feels blessed because he's been invited into her perspective. Right, she has this other view of time that ultimately throughout the course of the story sets him free. And I think reading as a whole does this in the classroom. So one of the primary things that I think you need to do in order for Shakespeare to work in the way that we're going to propose here in a few minutes is to read Shakespeare together in the classroom. Don't send it home. Right? Even if you have the most intelligent students who have ever existed and they get it, read it together. It slows you down, and it slows down the pace of your class. Because one of the things to remember is that we have to be sensitive to both clocks. We have to be sensitive to the clock of the text, what's happening, in what order. But we also have to be sensitive to the clocks that your students are probably worshiping on their wrist or on the wall, wherever it happens to be, constantly playing homage, you know, getting ready to bow their heads to it. And of course, one of the great things about classical Christian education is that we have these built-in things that help us to slow down. Feast days, right? Many of you probably participate in or even lead a feast day at your school. And if you don't, you should. It's a wonderful thing. So feast days are this kind of aspect that we already have, but often that's something that's outside the classroom, and so we don't tend to slow down in the classroom. It's go, 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 go. And so I want to read to you this quote from Gadamer as a way of transition. It is an intrinsic characteristic of every festival that it enjoys a specific rhythmical recurrence that elevates it above the flow of time. Eating, singing, exploring creative abilities in the classroom, these are things that should be regularly scheduled. And I think doing that will help you, particularly when tied back to this concept of Shakespeare, to bring festivity into your classroom. One of the great losses that I think we've experienced over the last 100 years or so of education is a loss of leisure. We feel pressure to get X, Y, Z done, even if we're not teaching to a test, right? Often it's because we're so excited about the things that we have to give students that we can't wait to give them more, but we have to wait. And so it has to be more than feast days. And so what are some other things that you might be able to do? Well, the first thing you can do is merge your humanities. Does anybody in here have a merged humanities program? Couple of you. Okay, good. I don't mean that you have an omnibus class and a literature class, or an omnibus class and a history class. I mean that you have one class taught by one teacher that covers literature, history, theology, all of these things. If you have that, great. Hopefully you'll learn some more things. Hopefully we're going to give you some things that can help you make it even better. If you don't have it, man, petition for it. I think it's so good and helpful to the education of your student. So let's look at this famous passage from John Milton that we all probably have memorized by heart because we're at the Repairing the Ruins conference. From hence and not till now will be the right season of forming them to be able writers and composers in every excellent matter, when they shall be thus fraught with a universal insight into things. We like to focus on that repairing the ruins, right? Adam messed things up, and it's our job to learn and fix all the problems. But there's far more to that document. If you haven't read that document, that's another thing to do. Read that document. It's short. It won't take up a whole lot of your time. But he's proposing a comprehensive education, and one of the aspects of it is his vision of these kind of blurred lines between the disciplines, right? He wants all the disciplines covered, but he talks about it in a way as though where one ends and one begins isn't really necessarily clear. And part of what leads him to that is this idea that by being exposed in this blended way, you get this universal insight into things. So I think Milton's concept here, particularly of seasons, is helpful, right? What does an appropriate festivity for a fourth grader look like compared to a tenth grader? They're certainly not the same. And you will have to consider things like school resources. What kind of volunteers do you have? There's all kinds of practical elements that have to go into those kind of outside of the classroom things. But if you're bringing festivity into the classroom, what you find is that those things become far more manageable. And if you've got students for a two-hour, dare I say, three-hour block of time, right, where you can really pour into them, then what happens is not only is your classroom transformed into a festival, but your students are transformed by the festival. Because essentially, what has to happen in order for you to do what we're going to propose here is you have to take time from the top of the priority list and move it to the bottom. You have to be okay if you don't finish Plutarch's Lives. You have to be okay if you don't finish that great novel that you love so much, right? There has to be an element of acceptance that I'm not going to get it all done. And I think one of the ways to do this is a retrieval of Christian humanism, which we can talk about in a little bit as we move on. But I would argue that a proper understanding of time, a proper way of inviting your students into the world of others, right? Of into the world of the book itself, is through an integrated classroom where your humanities are put into conversation every day through a text-driven mode. And I think that you can do, I think this can actually be done in all the seven liberal arts, including the maths and sciences. I don't teach the math and sciences, so I'm a little bit out of my depth there, but I think it can be done. But instead, I'm going to limit myself to what I know today, and that is the humanities. And actually, at this point, I'm going to turn it over to my co-speaker. This is Sean.
Are you speaking in the third person?
I know, right?
Yeah.
You don't know.
Hello. Thank you. Again, I just have to repeat what Sean already said. Thank you for being here. I'm surprised by how many of you got lost on your way to Louis Marcos or Chris Schlecht, or maybe just the vendor room, but thank you for staying. All joking aside, our topic is so multifaceted that some of you may be here for one reason and others may be here for another, and others still may be here for more reasons that I can't even fathom. But there may be some of you who are just dying to hear somebody talk about Shakespeare, some of you who don't have an integrated humanities program at your school and would really like one. And I don't know what the makeup of this room is in that regard, so I'm going to try and address at least those two major interests in turn, first with something that's a little bit heady and then with some more practical remarks. And I will even attempt to end with a list of pairings of works that you can consider working into your curriculum, Shakespeare plays and other great works, historical, literary, philosophical, theological, from the Western canon that you can put into conversation, and I'll maybe even suggest some topics and themes that you can draw out of that combination. But if there are still skeptics in the audience as integrating the humanities goes, I should clarify that our proposal of Shakespeare as a key to an integrated curriculum is not arbitrary, nor is it a gimmick. We are not suggesting that you can simply take your favorite author and make them the cornerstone of a functional education. This is the integrated humanities featuring Ernest Hemingway. No, what we're proposing might only work with a handful of other authors and works. In fact, I'm willing to limit that list to Homer, the Bible, Shakespeare, maybe Dante. And we all know that Shakespeare helped write the Bible, so those two kind of go together. Who in here didn't know that Shakespeare helped write the Bible? You all knew. Okay. Good. Because when did the King James Version of the Bible appear? If you're from the South, you could rattle it off, right? Man, that's 1611 version. 1611. I'm originally from Oregon. This is a rabbit trail. But I moved to Florida. And my first day, we were unpacking the moving truck. And some nice ladies came by and said, hello, welcome to the neighborhood. We want to invite you to our church. And don't worry, we only use the 1611. And that was jarring, but exciting for someone who enjoys literature. I'm like, yeah, all right. That's a pen of iron. That's good stuff. But 1611 was also about the time Shakespeare was getting ready to retire from public life. He's having his house in Stratford built. And the king of the realm assembles the greatest scholars and literary minds to write an English translation of the Bible. But that's just a conspiracy. It ceases to be a conspiracy, though, when you open your King James Version of the Bible to Psalm 46, and you count 46 words in from the beginning. Shake. And then you go to the end of the psalm, and you count backward 46 words. Spear. And even that is just coincidence. Except, who would ever notice that? Unless the person responsible sidled up to one of his buds and said, "You'll never believe what I did in Psalm 46. And that's why I believe that that's the real deal. But I can't prove it. I can't prove it. Change your life. But I think the list of great works that you can try and do this with, that you can use as helps or tutors, as you can use as a Virgil guiding you through hell and purgatory, is very small, because it only works with the greatest of works, because of what all great works have in common. And to talk about that, I have to talk about something else, and that is that the cosmos, everything, is a unity. The idea for us that the best kind of humanities classroom is an integrated humanities classroom really rests on this idea that the entire cosmos is a unity. It is a unified whole. The world was made by and through and for the Logos. And what is Logos? You could translate it as word or as reason, but it's really the ordering principle, the unifying principle. The cosmos was made, factus est, it's an artifact. It's a made thing, and a short name for an artifact is art. The ordering force that created the cosmos, then, is the artist. Then we come along. Little artists made in the image of the great artist. Little makers made in the image of the great maker. When we make art, then, its quality depends on how well we have rendered the essence of our maker's art. And that essence is the Logos, Christ. St. Paul says in Colossians 1 that all things were created through Jesus. And if you trace just through the writings of Paul the phrase "all things," some really fascinating stuff begins to emerge. But I digress. He says all things were created through Jesus and for him, and all things consist in him, and that it pleases the Father, or pleased the Father, to reconcile all things to himself through him, and that in him all the fullness should dwell. And on top of it all, Paul tells Timothy, God has given us all things richly to enjoy. How? By giving us Christ, of course. So all things come together in Christ, and therefore anything can express the Logos. But what makes great works and great artists truly great is that they do it far better than the rest of us. So, the cosmos is a unity. And Shakespeare is really uniquely positioned in history to appreciate that unity more fully than the pagans that I named earlier. Or pagan, I guess, Homer. He had the benefit of seeing not only what Plato did with the pre-Socratics, or what Aristotle did with Plato, but what St. Paul did with Aristotle, what Augustine did with St. Paul, and what Aquinas and Dante did with Augustine. As our understanding of Christ, of the Logos, the organizing principle, deepens over time, the ability of our great artists to discern and imitate the order of the cosmos also deepens. I don't think he knows it, but this seems to be what scholar and critic Harold Bloom is getting at when he speaks of Shakespeare as the inventor of the human. He says that Shakespeare really creates or pioneers new realms of human existence. And I think it's Harold Bloom's way of accidentally articulating a profound theological truth. And part of that hinges, in Bloom's mind, on Shakespeare's many personalities, the many types that he's able to create and incarnate in his drama. If God's created cosmos is a work of art, Shakespeare treats it like a diamond. He turns it over and over and over and over in his hand to let the light play on all the different facets, to see and understand it from as many perspectives as possible. So the man who created Iago also created Uncle Toby and Hamlet and Rosalind. And I could fill the time just naming the rest of them. This has some bearing on our own relationship to these texts, then, as educators. And it's no coincidence that Shakespeare himself received a classical education. Famously, his epitaph, written by Ben Jonson, one of his great rivals, says that Shakespeare had little Latin and less Greek. But it's really a kind of tongue-in-cheek statement about Shakespeare's education, because he went to a grammar school in Elizabethan England, which means that he would have had a better Greek and Latin education than all of us, probably. He doesn't have more Latin and Greek because he didn't go to Oxford afterward. But I haven't been to Oxford either. And when he went to the grammar school, he was put into the hands of a grammaticus who taught him his letters, his languages, and did it largely through a kind of discursive teaching through classic works of literature, chiefly Homer, some Roman poets. And so the fact that Shakespeare received this kind of education, where one or a small handful of texts served as the jumping-off point for broad education, I think makes him helpful and useful to us as we think through integrating multiple disciplines into our study of great works. Because then Shakespeare became an artist, and so for us he becomes the diamond that we can turn over again and again and view from a plethora of angles. And so you can look at Shakespeare from the perspective of various subjects or disciplines. Shakespeare as literature, or the works of Shakespeare as literature, probably is the thing that requires the least amount of argument or defense here. That's sort of Shakespeare's thing. Literature, it's pretty obvious. The English language owes a great debt to Shakespeare. We wouldn't say or think many of the things that we say and think, at least not in the shape that we say and think them, if it weren't for him. So to say that you can read a Shakespeare play and call that studying literature is not a stretch. Nor is it really that difficult to argue that Shakespeare can be history or can be a gateway into the study of history. A good percentage of Shakespeare's plays are categorized as histories. G.K. Chesterton once wrote about Henry V, that the Henry V of Shakespeare is not indeed the Henry V of history, yet he is more historic. Now, this idea that Shakespeare does not just retell historical events, but he digs into the meaning of those historical events and presents them to us in his plays. And then Shakespeare as theology, or Shakespeare the playwright as theologian, as possibly the most controversial thing. But even that is easy to come to terms with when you begin to tick off the examples of theological inquiry and angst, the plethora of biblical allusions and quotations. Shakespeare is thoroughly steeped in the things of Scripture, in the things of the church, and he's bringing them to bear on really difficult and poignant questions. I have in the outline in your book a fairly well-known quote from Hamlet: "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy." Shakespeare imagines that as soon as you read that line or hear that line acted, you'll say, like what? In fact, Hamlet, you could really read all of Hamlet as a theological inquiry, the whole play. The opening line of Hamlet, anybody know the first line of Hamlet? Who's there? Who's there? And that theme and refrain is picked up later in the play, in the famous to be or not to be speech. One of the things that Hamlet is wrestling with is, when you die, who's there? Where do you go? And finally, the moment that you know that Hamlet has found some kind of peace or some kind of conviction is when he tells his friend, "You know what, Horatio? You know what I've realized? There's a divinity that shapes our ends, refute them how we will." Hamlet is wrestling with theological questions almost until the moment of his death, when he finally finds an answer. And so I think it's valid to look at Shakespeare as something that is multifaceted and that can also augment our appreciation of other works. In the same play, Hamlet, Hamlet gives some advice to play actors that come visiting his castle. And it's the only passage, or at least it's the longest passage by far, that is in prose. It's the only extended passage of prose in the entire play. A play full of acting and deceit and falsehoods. There's this one moment where Hamlet is really frank. He's straightforward. He tells the truth. He drops the pretense of rhyming verse. And he just has a good time with these players and tells them what he truly believes. And it's some great advice. It's good teaching advice, frankly. He says, "Be not too tame neither, but let your discretion be your tutor. Suit the action to the word, the word to the action. With this special overstep, not the modesty of nature. For anything so overdone is from the purpose of playing, whose end, both at the first and now, was and is to hold, as 'twere, the mirror up to nature. To show virtue her own feature, scorn her own image, and the very age and body of the time is form and pressure." To hold the mirror up to nature. And I want to argue that Shakespeare can be our mirror, that we can hold Shakespeare's plays up to the world, ourselves, and other great works, and a great deal of truth will be reflected. That Shakespeare's plays can serve then as a kind of parable. The word parable comes from the Greek, and it literally means throw next to, throw alongside, for the purpose of comparison. Nathan the prophet tells David a parable. Here's a story about a nice man and a bad man. And at the end of the story, when it's clear David has has entered into the fiction and is really wrapped up in what's going on. Wow, I would have that man put to death. Tell me, who is this man? And Nathan says, well, let's draw some comparisons between that story and your own life. Why don't we? Because you are the man. And then, of course, David is undone. So the parable is to come alongside, and I think Shakespeare's plays serve that purpose well. To come alongside of other great works that are also working very hard to express the nature of the Logos, and through reflection to help us see then the kind of family resemblance. Having said all that, I want to let Sean come back and take you through scenarios and explain how he makes use of Shakespeare in our curriculum, and then I will conclude by offering a number of example pairings and groupings of works and some suggested themes and threads that you might be able to draw out of those pairings as you plan your own courses.
So the other aspect of your handout is what I have historically given to... Time's is over? 5:30. Okay, good. What I have historically given to parents on the orientation day. And it has all of the materials that we'll be covering. It has a couple of little blurbs at the top about why we do what we do, some explanations of assignments, and then a brief excursus at the bottom on our separate theology text, the text that we do just a couple times a week. But both of these are ancient courses. It might be easiest to roll out this kind of program in the ancient, although the medieval certainly has its own aspects that would lend some ease to that as well. But I think the ancient world is probably the easiest place to experiment with these pairings, to take the Shakespeare and to take the other great works and to put them in conversation and to invite the students to then see themselves in that. And this is the way I've done it most recently. This is something that's constantly in flux. I'm sure some of you are familiar with how that works. So I haven't done it the same way every time, but this was the most recent way that I went through this course. And so if you look at the first one, it says Tragedia 1 at the top. That's our seventh grade class. And so we've got students reading the Iliad and Ruth and the Oresteia and Herodotus and all these great things. And specifically, we have ended out the year, spent the last quarter going through Livy and then through Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Because Livy to them is far removed, right? When we read Livy, even though we spend quite a bit of time on his preface, which I think clearly shows, despite the distance in time, that what he's talking about are universal issues that span across the ages. As soon as you get into the story of Romulus and Remus, the students are like, this is old, and this is not necessarily pertinent to me. And so once we get through, we just do the first two books of Livy, and then I lecture about the books 3, 4, and 5. And I do that so that we can move a little bit faster in that section. We linger on books 1 and 2. We take about 2 weeks to go through those, and then a couple of days to summarize books 3, 4, and 5, and immediately then jump into Julius Caesar. The way I have done this is I don't spend a lot of time on the Shakespearean aspect of it at first. I actually save that for the back end. What I do is we move from the Gauls have sacked Rome. Livy is lamenting that Rome's greatest moment is gone. And then we immediately pick up with Julius Caesar, right? And the birth of what will become the Roman Empire. It's jarring at first, right? So we round out Livy, and then the very next thing we read is these tribunes, right? And they're talking to guys walking through the street, and they're like, who are you? He's like, I'm a mender of bad souls, meaning he's a cobbler. but the tribune doesn't understand. And there's this great interchange that goes back and forth that about half the seventh graders get, half of them don't get, right? Which is fun in and of itself. But then we begin to explore, and I keep reminding them, hey, you remember when Livy talked about the tribunes? You remember when Livy explained how the Senate worked? You're seeing this play out here. So there's constantly this connection, right? But we hit those really great moments where Caesar is contemplating whether or not to go to the Senate. And Calpurnia says, I had this vision, this dream of a statue of you with holes and blood pouring out of it. Please don't go. And we stop and we what do you make of that? You know, and they're seventh graders. It takes them a little while to get anywhere with it. But it's so good once they get to this idea of taking signs, taking clear indications, no matter what form they come, and twisting them to one's own end, which is what Caesar ultimately does in that scene. I want to be emperor. The Senate will make me that. I'm going to go. Right? And, you know, I even working a little bit there, the wisdom of listening to your wife or your mother, and which, you know, I get eye rolls from seventh grade boys about that. But one day, they'll know, right? They'll know, just hopefully not the way Caesar did. And so we move through that, and then we get to the latter half of the play where Brutus is really wrestling with what's happened, right? And we stop. Have any of you ever betrayed a friend because of something selfish that you wanted? Oh, but they defend Brutus, right? This is the thing that always amazed me. They defend Brutus. He was doing it for the good of Rome. Yeah, but was he? And it gives them something to really chew on and think about. And it's the way we close out the year, which I think is just fantastic. We spend about 3 weeks on Julius Caesar. And then the last couple of years, I've had them reading Ben-Hur while that's going on as well. They're reading Ben-Hur at home on their own. And so they're bringing in all kinds of interesting connections between those texts. And so we have this kind of three-part series where all these things come together in that class. We have historically worked on a three-year cycle. And so in the 10th grade, 3 years later, they return to the ancient period. And I'm not going to repeat what I've already taught them. And so we do still use a Shakespeare Roman play, but this time we do Coriolanus. And so we go about it a little bit differently. We finish up Thucydides. We kind of speed read through the Aeneid. And then we jump into Coriolanus. And again, I don't start with the Shakespearean elements. Remember, you know, this is written by a guy in the Elizabethan era, those kinds of things. We jump straight into the play, and then we work out those details about Shakespeare as we go along, right? Oh, he just used this English word. Any of you know what it means, right? No. Oh, well, there's a footnote at the bottom of your page. Did you know that? Oh, hey, there's a footnote, right? And so we go through all of those kinds of things as we progress. But in Coriolanus, we see that same kind of thing, especially coming off of the heels of the Aeneid and the character of Aeneas and who he is, and then to think about who Coriolanus was in Roman history. And of course, if the students have been there since seventh grade, they have the benefit of the Livy, and so we can bring that back to bear. I had a really good experience this last year with students being able to recall the things we did as seventh graders. And to go, oh, I remember that. I remember this guy from Livy. He was, yeah, wasn't he the guy whose mom yelled at him or something outside the city gates? I'm like, yeah, that's great. Well, now we're going to see what happens, right, in more detail, right? And this is also a really good place where we talk about Shakespeare's sources. I don't so much do that with the seventh grade level, but at the 10th grade level, it's great to talk to them about his use of Plutarch and all of those kinds of things and how Shakespeare... one of the reasons Shakespeare's plays are so wonderful and so helpful is because they're built upon an in-depth knowledge themselves. Shakespeare knew this material. He had to in order to craft these characters this way, or even to make the changes that he does. He brings the character of Menenius into Coriolanus, who wasn't alive when Coriolanus was alive. But Menenius is famous in Livy for telling the parable of the body. Well, if you want to make sense of Coriolanus and his pride, you really have to know the Roman parable of the body. And so he puts those two things together in the play itself. And so we talk about that kind of artistry as well. And so this is how we try to weave it together, right? And again, I linger on the Shakespearean elements longer than I might other parts, right? This might hurt some of you, but I only spend about a week on Thucydides, right? It's about 8 to 10 hours, give or take. So we obviously don't read it all, right? But I spend anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks on Coriolanus because it enables me to draw on these other sources that we've touched on and then to bring them together and to flush them out in a story, but also in a way that the students can see themselves in it. And so I think Sean is, with the little bit of time we have remaining, going to come up and give some other suggestions outside of these in terms of what you can put together. But this is really my ultimate suggestion, to read Shakespeare in class and to take a long time on it, right? Even if you don't have an integrated program, even if you're the English teacher, put other things to the side, right? And spend this kind of time on Shakespeare because it does allow you to draw all of these elements out and bring them together and to put them in contrast with one another. Just one more thing about the Coriolanus. I will send the students home to also read portions of Joshua, right, as we're reading through Coriolanus, and then have them come back and tell me, what does that do, right? How does that inform the way you're reading this? So there's a number of ways you can do this, but I think following the cycle or following a cycle of some kind is going to be the most helpful, and then really spend time in class on Shakespeare. I think that's going to be the best thing. So hopefully Sean has some, not hopefully, I know he does. He has some good suggestions for you here. So,
yeah, and Sean's, that is really weird. I apologize that we have the same name. Sean's comments about the use of Coriolanus, the way that he makes use of Coriolanus, and is able to draw so much into the conversation about one work, goes a long way, I think, to supporting what we're agitating for, trying to pitch to you the idea of an integrated humanities class or win you over and make you the bane of your administrator while you agitate for a integrated humanities class. And that is that so much value comes from a conversation. That's probably a given in classical education. We put a lot of emphasis on dialogue and dialectic, Socratic discussion. Conversation produces the thing we are after. And so any approach that allows you to put multiple works in conversation is really valuable, and one of the reasons we're here recommending this. So Sean gave you two examples of ways that he fits Shakespeare's historical plays, Julius Caesar and Coriolanus, into a course dealing with the period in which they are set, and that is certainly a natural thing to do and a safe thing to do. So if you have not tried to build an integrated humanities curriculum of any kind, it's a good first step. But it's not necessarily the only way to go forward. One of my former history professors was fond of saying, chronologic is a valid logic, but chrono is not the only logic. So there are other means of organizing your curriculum. There are other logos or ordering principles than chronos, time. And so what I'm going to do in suggesting some pairings of works that will get the most out of each other is offer some that fit into a kind of chronological scheme, but others that suggest or invite you to think about organizing a class around themes or topics, or doing both, following a chronological scheme but not being afraid to pull from other time periods. If you have been a classical educator for very long, you're probably familiar, or not, you may be familiar, hopefully have read, C.S. Lewis's essay on the reading of old books, where he commends that very thing, the reading of old books, for the reason that our time is what has made us, and so reading books from our time is only going to confirm our own biases and ignore our own blind spots. That's true, too, if we're reading books from just one other time. And so the more periods you can draw from, the more voices and perspectives you have in your conversation. So having said that, I'm going to offer really just rattle off a list with some short justifications of Shakespeare plays that you can pair with other great works. Some are obvious because Shakespeare himself suggests them. In Henry V, Shakespeare has his characters quote from Machiavelli's The Prince, and the main character, Henry V, explicitly tells at least the audience in some soliloquies that he is acting, that he's pretending to be something that he's not, or was pretending to be something that he wasn't, and doing that for political advantage. Machiavelli lends himself pretty neatly to that conversation. So does Richard III, who is also explicitly upfront about his machinations. And then with those readings, I would suggest pairing things like Thucydides, the original political realist, Thomas Hobbes, who has a lot to say to Richard III, and also owes a lot to Thucydides. The first book Thomas Hobbes ever published was his own translation of Thucydides, Peloponnesian War. You could pair just about anything with Hamlet, and Hamlet to young people in the year 2018 or 19 is eminently applicable. It's a book of revelations and revolutions. Hamlet is a play about worlds falling apart, or old worlds passing away and new worlds coming into being, and a young man trapped in the middle. In fact, if you really want to get crazy, you could teach Hamlet in your science class. Hamlet was written in the year 1600. It's set in Denmark. It's set in the year in the 11 or 1200s, but it was written in the year 1600. And contemporary with Shakespeare was a man named Kepler. You heard of this guy? He was the first popularizer of the Copernican heliocentric view of the cosmos. And Kepler was the student of a man named Tycho Brahe. Kepler was a Pole, by the way. He was Polish. And his mentor, Tycho Brahe, lived in Denmark. And Hamlet is a play about the upheavals going on between Poland and Denmark and England, who makes an appearance there. So the Copernican Revolution and Hamlet would make a fascinating conversation, I think. I like to pair Hamlet with Boethius' Consolation of Philosophy. I think Hamlet is paraphrasing at more than one point passages from Boethius. Also, a man wrestling with a life that has been really good and all of a sudden is racked by tragedy and suffering and grief, and it causes him to question the justice of God. Having said that, perhaps throw Job into that mix. And because you can't actually read too much Shakespeare, why don't you follow that up with King Lear? And after you've read Lear, why don't you read Oedipus? And then Wiseblood, Flannery O'Connor. blind prophets and men gouging their eyes out, tragic revelations, seeing and not seeing. It's all there. It's all there. If any of you teach Brave New World, you have to have read all of Shakespeare. It's impossible. It's a lot to ask your students. But Brave New World makes a natural pairing with a lot of Shakespeare. Measure for Measure, particularly. Measure for Measure centers around questions of ultimate meaning. Is there chaos and void at the heart of the world? Or is there some benevolent deity that has created it all and has a wonderful plan for our lives? What have you read in Macbeth and The Great Gatsby together? I'll just let you think about that one. A Midsummer Night's Dream and Ovid's Metamorphosis or Apuleius' Metamorphosis seem like natural pairings. As You Like It, a comedy about leaving the city and finding freedom and safety out in the wilderness. Maybe read that with the Pentateuch, the Exodus. Or works about the settling of America. How about Othello and Paradise Lost and Frankenstein? Robinson Crusoe, Montaigne's On the Cannibals, and The Tempest, which quotes from On the Cannibals. And then when you finish that reflection on man's nature and natural law, you could follow it up with Rousseau's Social Contract or John Locke's Second Treatise on Government. You could read Love's Labor's Lost in the midst of a conversation about monasticism or holy orders. In fact, vocational celibacy runs through a lot of great works of literature. Frodo and Bilbo Baggins are vocationally celibate men. Just about any work of Shakespeare and Aristotle, to be or not to be, any Greek philosopher would have a field day with that conversation. Or as Sean suggested earlier, a high-level historical exercise might be to analyze Shakespeare's use of his own source material. Or lastly, maybe your whole faculty reads The Taming of the Shrew as a teacher in service. It's a play all about education, how one is educated, what forms of education are most effective and kindest to the people being educated. And there are more. I could go on, but I won't. As a parting note, though, I'll remind you that no man has seen the Father except as the Son has revealed him, has incarnated him. Because our students are incarnate souls, and because truth must be incarnated before it can be fully grasped, the presence of drama in any curriculum is invaluable. Not only are dramatic, choreographed readings conducive to the leisurely education Sean discussed at the beginning of our talk, acting a play, even with little or no practice, forces you to take time. But if you have paired Shakespeare with works sharing similar themes and emotions, acting through portions or all of a play, you really could do it. You could do it. We'll have them embodying the very ideas they're studying. And that's the goal of education. Thank you so much for your time. We are out of it. We've wasted it, and now it's wasting us. But we'd be happy to answer any questions in conversation afterward that you might have. Again, thank you for coming.